That's What She Said is fueled by Gatorade. Whatever path you take to greatness, Gatorade is there to fuel it. Greatness starts with G. 30 for 30 is back with Breakaway, a film about WNBA superstar and activist Maya Moore. This film explores the story of Moore, one of the best basketball players in the world, stepping away from the sport for a remarkable reason: to fight for a man she believed was wrongly imprisoned. Stream now on ESPN+. Also, Mike Greenberg, host of Greeny on ESPN Radio, will get you ready for NFL training camps and the latest Aaron Rodgers news. That's Greeny on ESPN Radio, weekdays from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, or listen to the podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain, a podcast about, well, whatever the hell I want. Actors and musicians, athletes, comedians, neuroscientists, wine experts. If I find somebody interesting, I'm bringing them to you. We'll talk about how they became who they are, how they found success, battled failures, and how they ended up here talking to me.
I'm Brendan Hunt, and my dilemma is I'm a Bears fan who shares a child with a Vikings fan, and that child is being raised in Los Angeles.
Okay, so I know this one well. My niece and nephew are a constant battleground for sports loyalties in the family. I've thankfully got them both locked in on the Red Stars, proudly rocking their gear to sports day at school. But my sister and I are battling their dad on the MLB front. We are offering up lots of Cubs gear, and we're trying to counteract his Red Sox fandom. And I think it's going to help us that they live in Chicagoland. We can actually take him to Cubs games. Plus, obviously, the ubiquitousness of Northside gear around these parts helps. So it's going to be tougher for you. You have to navigate parents of different loyalties and living in enemy territory for a third team. But what I will tell you is this, from having lived in L.A. Outside of SoFi Stadium, if you look at the rest of L.A. and its surrounding areas, there are probably more fans wearing Bears gear than Rams. Because we travel, and all the Chicago folks who live there proudly rocking the gear all the time. I mean, I think we all know LA fans don't really show up till the postseason out there. They've got, you know, movie premieres and beaches and, you know, attractive people meetings to attend, I presume. Because I remember when I lived there and those Lakers car flags were popping up in the spring as if the season hadn't already been going on for months. So stand strong. I believe that the pull of the Bears and their rabid fan base is powerful enough to take out the Rams and the Vikings. But do not let the kids get their hands on one of those Vikings yaller horns. Because if you put that with one of those helmets with the horns, I don't know, man. That could really capture their attention and their imaginations. And that could lead them to a very sad, very dark, very purple place.
That's what she said.
It's rare to meet someone who doesn't like the show Ted Lasso. If you don't know about it, Jason Sudeikis is an American football coach hired to coach a British football team. And it gives you some of the regular fish out of water hijinks that you'd expect, but so much more heart and humor and a real subversion of the sitcom tropes that feels progressive and thoughtful, witty and warm. You could find people who haven't seen the show yet. Absolutely. But someone who has watched Ted Lasso and didn't suddenly feel like their body was made up of sunshine and rainbows, haven't seen it. Haven't met a one. So I was actually surprised when I read a critique of the show in the Washington Post by columnist Ingu Kang. She said plenty of nice things, but she also wrote in part, quote, Ted Lasso is a fantasy of decency, of non-toxic masculinity, of leadership through emotional intelligence. It's kindness porn, a la Schitt's Creek, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and Parks and Recreation. Shows with fervid fan bases that cherish, rather than question, those series' credulity-straining, tolerant settings. And she later writes, quote, it is, of course, totally fine that Ted Lasso is a fantasy. Most fictional series, and many nonfiction works for that matter, eschew verisimilitude or complicating realities. But it's also wholly fair to not want what Ted Lasso is selling, which is where I often find myself. Now, she's, of course, allowed to her opinion. And not everyone wants decency in their entertainment. A lot of people prefer their escapes to come with violence or drug lords, you know, the dark underbelly of society. But the part that got me was calling it, quote, a fantasy of decency, non-toxic masculinity, and leadership through emotional intelligence. That's not a fantasy to me. You know, that can be our reality if we want it to be. At the very least, it can be a goal instead of an annoyance. And in my years covering sports, I've found it shocking how many people just can't seem to wrap their heads around the idea of going through life without, say, committing domestic violence or getting in a terrible bar fight or sexually assaulting someone. I know that sounds ridiculous, but come to my mentions and see how often it's like you haven't made a mistake or bet you wouldn't like someone digging into your past. You can call me Pollyanna-ish. I've heard it before. You could tell me I live in an ivory tower. Wouldn't be the first time. But I'm kind of done apologizing for having higher expectations for humanity, for myself and others. Absolutely, second chances are important. Absolutely, the traumas and challenges that people grow up with can result in behaviors that later cause shame. Absolutely, I have been incredibly lucky to live where I've lived, to be raised by the people I have, to have had the opportunities I have. But I also make choices over and over again in pursuit of decency. And in the moment, as we live our everyday and we make choices about ourselves and others and how we want to affect the world, can we at least try to refuse accepting that decency has to be a fantasy? Because I'm not perfect, but I'm sure as hell trying to get as close as I can to be a person that I can be proud of, that other people can look up to, that makes other people's lives better, fairer, and more joyful. And if we just let cynics convince us that cruelty, selfishness, toxic masculinity, women be catfighting, and just general shittiness are an inescapable reality, I don't want to live in that world. So if Ted Lasso gets a few more people to react with emotional intelligence and talk things through instead of coming to blows and consider the feelings of others and engage in ways that feel decent and mature and emotionally intelligent, then I'm buying what it's selling every day and twice on Sunday. And I'm guessing that my guest this week agrees. Brendan Hunt, who plays Coach Beard on Ted Lasso, is a co-creator, writer, and actor on the show. He's also known for being in We're the Millers and Horrible Bosses 2. Also TV like Key and Peele, Community, Parks and Rec, How I Met Your Mother. He's an alum of the famed Second City and Boom Chicago improv comedy groups. Chicago native. And he is a delight. I had such a great time talking to him. And I know you're going to love listening.
That's what she said.
I don't know that I've had more jealousy surrounding me pronouncing a guest would be forthcoming on this podcast than perhaps Brendan Hunt, a.k.a. Coach Beard, because the Ted Lasso insanity is real. And we're going to get to all the Ted Lasso goodness, but I want to go way back to you growing up in the Chicago area, going to school downstate in the prairie land parts of Illinois that I've had people in California ask me how far away Chicago is from Illinois. So I guess that tells you the people aren't really very well versed in the other parts of the state. Let's start with where you grew up and what kind of kid were you?
So I sort of grew up all over the North Side. My parents divorced when I was like two, and then my mom tried to take care of me and my sister by herself. I hear that there's songs about how single momming is right, hard. But this was before even those songs came out, didn't have the cachet that it enjoys today. Just kind of all over the North Side. And so I was kind of a hyperactive kid, if not clinically, at least, spiritually, and kind of already angry from a young age. Like I remember a report card from either first or third grade. The reason why I don't know is because it's a school that I know that I went to two different times.
Always a good time.
I'm not sure when this was, but there was, I remember a report card that said 37 and a half absences in like a quarter or a semester. Like it was something insane. My mom didn't know. She was going to work and I was willfully at the age of, like 8 or 9, willfully staying home and watching, Tom and Jerry and Brady Bunch and Green Acres all day.
Wow. Okay. So do you attribute that to probably just the uncertainty and the inconsistency of a life of early divorce and then your mom working a lot?
For sure. And which, planted the seeds for teen anger.
Which is what produces great comedians. I've said all along that the reason my comedy career never took off is because I'm far too well adjusted. I'm a very happy person. I didn't have the angst to build from. Did you get into comedy young?
I like to think a little bit that I got into comedy because of my love of Tom and Jerry and Woody Woodpecker and Bugs Bunny and all those that were running in that gamut on WFLD at the time. Those things, they teach you violence, I guess, but they also teach you timing. Like the timing is still to this day, metronome, perfect. I did see a Second City show on a school trip in eighth grade and that was definitely incredibly transformative. Like, I was just blown away by what they were doing. Bonnie Hunt was the main person in the cast at that time. And she in particular was like, this lady's amazing. And I might have just been paying attention because I'd never met another person named Hunt before. But that was a big deal. But even by then, because I wasn't just, you know, glued to the TV while I should have been at school, I was also watching, you know, Carson and Letterman well into the night as well, and SNL as well. So yeah, comedy was definitely cooking from early on.
Who do you remember? We all have the cast of SNL that maybe we feel the most connected to. And there's other eras and generations that we love. But like, for me, it was the Phil Hartman, Nora Dunn, Victoria Jackson. Like, that stretch, I think, was when that sweet spot of being old enough to get more of the jokes, but young enough to have zero plans.
Yeah, it's sort of like, it's a bit of a string bet here, because, you know, I was watching early enough to enjoy, you know, the Aykroyd Belushi era, but still a little young to get it. And then Eddie Murphy came on, and no one can say that was the best time at first, because that was kind of a dark period. But I couldn't take my eyes off Eddie Murphy. But the first cast that like felt like they were sort of my cast was that cast that was only there a year, that Billy Crystal, Christopher Guest, you know, Martin Short, Rick Hall. I was Rick Hall and Rich Hall confused. One was on SNL, the other one was in that Second City show I saw with Bonnie Hunt. So that one really, really just got
the Eddie Murphy years all become one to me, because I just used to rent Best of Eddie Murphy SNL VHS at Blockbuster over and over again when I was way too young, and then I would repeat all of it around the house. Ha, I'm Velvet Jones, like just nonstop. But that was not like as much of a every Saturday. That was just I rented it over and over and over again. Okay, so you're into comedy, and did you feel like when you got into high school and later you felt like you could harness that for the energy and the sort of hyperactivity that you referenced?
I don't know that I was ever as conscious as that, but you know, looking back, you know, I was just very combustible. I just had so much, you know, so much anger going on about you know, my family. And I had a stepdad by then who has since stood the test of time, but you know, you bring a stepdad in, you know, to a you know, teenager's life, and it's like, no. So I definitely, like, I started doing school plays, and then we started an improv group at my high school, improv and sketch group, and which I ran roughshod over in retrospect. I was not sharing the ball in the way that I should have. But I just remember it feeling like an inevitability, like it, the energy of it, the release of it, was that was it. You know, there was never going to be anything else. I mean, there was a brief time when I wanted to be a baseball statistician. I remember there was an article in the Tempo section, you know, in those early days where like even Bill James's name wasn't out there, but he was already, you know, pioneering. And the White Sox in the early La Russa era had a statistician, and I was like, yes, that's my future. But then you do the King and I one time, and all that just goes out the window.
See, that's a lot of people. It's that moment where you have to decide between statistician and Shakespearean actor. So it's very common. It's very accessible for everyone listening now, that moment of decision for you. I heard a different podcast. You talked about the aforementioned stepdad was a Packers fan, which initially caused some problems, but then it required your dad to think fast and bring you to the NFC Championship game, the Super Bowl year, or some massive game you had never been taken. Yeah. But the jealousy of potentially you attaching a bond to the stepdad and the Packers fandom was enough to push your father's hand.
Yeah. I mean, that's my theory in retrospect, because it was an uncharacteristic, uncharacteristic big move by my dad. But it was out of nowhere. And that was the 85 team of who I was, of course, you know, besotted by. That January morning, my mom says, wake up, your dad's coming to take you to the game. And it was jaw droppingly shocking. Like, what?
Amazing.
What the hell? As you may have heard, that day worked out pretty good.
I heard. I wasn't old enough to enjoy it, and now I've spent my entire life hearing about how great it is, and then seeing their names on every car dealership and event in town, waiting for someone to come in and give that feeling again. decades and decades later. Okay, so you end up at Illinois State University. You get involved in the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. You pop out and head to Second City almost immediately. Was that like the first place you went after college?
No, I got like bullied into auditioning for Comedy Sports, and had a great time there. And you know, if I'd been more discerning, if I'd taken the lay of the land, I might have known that at IO some really interesting stuff was happening there, and you know, the Amy Poehlers of the world were starting to connect. But yeah, I tended to find path of least resistance, and oh, I'm in Comedy Sports now. Okay, great, that's what I do. But I did start taking classes at Second City pretty shortly after that, and then was about to start taking classes at IO. Literally, had signed up before I got the job in Amsterdam, yeah. And off I went.
It's pretty wild how you can look back at different little pods at various improv places and say, I wish I'd known. Like when I was at Second City in LA, the big things were at UCB, but like you're already in it. So you're like, oh, should I go over there to where we're now hearing about Keegan-Michael Key and whoever else is like doing various things. But you made good on it because you end up, like you said, in Amsterdam at Boom Chicago. And we've had Ike Barinholtz on the pod before talking about that. And there's a ton of great, I mean, Jordan Peele and Seth Meyers and all sorts of great people out there. You were out there. I heard you said another pod, you extended your time in Southern Illinois beyond perhaps the 4 years one traditionally allots for college. It feels like you did the same thing in Amsterdam. You were out there for a pretty long stretch compared to a lot of people who go do Boom Chicago, right?
Yeah, when I got the job, I was like, all right, I'll do it for a year. But that's it. But at the end of that year, you know, it wasn't just a good job and a great city and seeing the world for the first time. It was, you know, Amsterdam's good for your soul. Dutch philosophy of life is good for your soul. And so I was like, all right, one more year. And Ike and I actually joined at the same time. We were on the same flight and everything. Yeah. And so he also stayed for another year. And around that time, most people were staying for 2 years, which is the move. Because like, take a year, and I think this is a move for almost any new place. Like, take a year that no matter where you're going, if it's a new place, that first year is figuring that place the fuck out, you know? And then the second year is when, like, okay, all right, I got this. And after 2 years, Ike, like most sane people, you know, left. I stayed for three more years after that. And then the following 4 years after moving to LA and getting nothing going here, I just kept going back to Amsterdam. So I kind of piecemealed two more years after the first five.
Yeah, I was looking through the timeline.
And I regret nothing.
I mean, Amsterdam's a decent place. Like you said, it's good for the soul in a variety of ways. I haven't been there yet, but I've heard the stories about it being a good spot and of the incredible reception for specifically Boom Chicago out there and what an incubator it can be. And you look at a lot of what came out of there. There's a little bit of hints at what's to come. Kick This, a World Cup comedy with balls, is something that you were involved in 2006. Also, The Unlikely Fan, same year, which was a World Cup video series for MSN. And so there's these little dabblings into the sports world. Did you have a fandom for either soccer or sports in outside of your Chicago fandom before you got there? Or did you learn in Amsterdam that there was something to this whole football thing?
Oh, entirely. Entirely Amsterdam, or damn near entirely. Like, are you old enough to remember like Chicago Sting commercials?
Only because I just watched The Last Dance, and they talked in The Last Dance about how the Chicago Sting was like a bigger draw than the Bulls before Jordan.
Yeah, we were being outdrawn by indoor soccer. That's my horrible
nailed it. I think that was Ryan Scorp. I'm not sure.
I never. Yeah, it never grabbed me. You know, the 94 World Cup kind of came and went. I watched a few games and it never grabbed me. And then, yeah, I get this job in Amsterdam and you can't watch Bears games anymore. You can't watch Bulls games anymore. And Michael Jordan just retired anyway. So I'm, you know, even more emotionally cratered than normal. And yeah, people just started saying like, you really, you know, just go to some soccer games. And started going to some Ajax games. That's the club team there. And going to some national team games. And then I moved in with eight Dutch guys in the summer before Euro 2000, which, you know, the European Championships, it's the World Cup, minus Brazil and Argentina. It's a big thing. And they built bleachers in our apartment. And it was amazing. And, you know, it's not just in my apartment, but also the whole city had been taken over. It's orange everywhere. And, you know, start going to games and just you find out that you know, yeah, soccer has flaws, but wait, all of our other games have flaws too. We just don't see them anymore because we're used to them. So I don't really buy too much the whole like, well, soccer's worse because of this or that. Like, if you want to pick holes in sports, we can do that all day. But soccer is compelling. It is dramatic. It's incredibly athletic. Yeah. You know, they're not big bruisers for the most part, but they're doing shit that I can't imagine doing. You know, if I'd ever started learning, you know, before being in my mid-20s.
So a real quick question about that living with eight Dutch guys. What was the size of this place? Was it a reasonable accommodation for that many dudes? Or is this like what I'm imagining, which is like a mini fraternity house where like trying to just catch a toilet when you need it is tough?
Somewhere in between. These guys had all gone to college together up north in a town called Groningen. And they had a buddy who like was buying properties in Amsterdam. And so he had the top three stories of this building. Nice. The bottom story was a McDonald's where I ate 1 to 2 meals every single day in my 5 years in Amsterdam. I'm not proud of that.
Yeah.
And then there was like a Thai restaurant and then our three stories. He was going to convert it into a hotel. I don't know if that ever happened or not, but it was a really like haphazard, weirdly shaped, but very spacious,
Sounds fun.
Great place to like bring.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, and it was literally around the corner from my theater. Like I would roll out of bed at 11:55 and be at rehearsal at 11:59.
Perfect.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I really quickly want to touch on, because I'm obsessed with Peanuts, and I just love it. And the fact that you had a whole play that you wrote and acted in that was like a dark comedy parody of the Peanuts called Absolutely Filthy, about Pigpen, who's homeless and trying to cope with a breakup from Sally. And I just, and also the fact that I heard that you came up with this play while dancing solo at Burning Man and looking around at the dust around you and thinking it reminded you of Pigpen. Like, first of all, I want to know which drugs were involved in that particular dancing by myself moment. And then just tell me a brief little bit. And can I find this play anywhere? I need to see it.
You can't find it anywhere yet.
Oh.
For a couple of reasons. One is, I'm not posting it online because I get naked in it, and you know you can't control the lighting.
Fair. And you just went swimming.
Comedy naked. Comedy naked. That's all. Also, like, it's not published yet because, like, I still hold out, you know, a small hope that it'll, you know, get to New York in one way or another, and like I want to be able to keep working on it until then. I don't want to have published it like before I thought of better bits. The drugs involved at the time were, I believe, mushrooms. Oh, mushrooms for sure. And I believe I'd been given Molly. I didn't ask for it. I didn't want it.
You were overserved. That was on them.
Things, also, yes, I was. I wildly, because like I had this great idea, but then soon I was like overheating, and like the sun had come up, and I'm wearing this big furry coat.
Did you write it down at the time, or did you actually remember it?
No, I actually remembered it. It was burned in my brain because the other drug was love. There was a girl there, a woman who I had like fallen for really intensely the year before. And I thought, like, you know, it was, you know, playa romance, as it's called. But it was like magic and a lightning bolt and all these things. She failed to mention that she had a fiance. And so now a year later, she's there, and like, I'm still sort of pining for her. So yeah, dancing by myself, having some heightened senses, but also, you know, my heart, you know, barely held together.
I asked because my husband and I went to our first Fish show a couple years ago with a friend who's been to 100-something, and he was really like, I'm going to take you. And we're like, we like some of the songs, but he's like, no, I really want you to experience it. And we wrote an entire Christopher Guest-style mockumentary about festival music while we were high as at the Fish show. And I kept putting the notes in my phone because I was like, I'm never going to remember this. And the next day we're going through, we're like, there's just a woman who's always breastfeeding in the shot, her baby, like her hippie baby, and the baby keeps getting older, but she's still always there breastfeeding, doesn't have any lines. We created all these characters, and then we were like, we should get high more often. Like, we're so creative. And then we were like, but we also don't accomplish anything. We just think it's hilarious. And then go back and look at the notes and wonder, like, what the f- did we think that? Anyway, I haven't done mushrooms, so maybe I should up my game a little.
You got to write.
And then, yeah,
it's important. Like, your job is not to judge those things in the moment. You know, your job is to give yourself the record of what came up, and then in sober times, then you can decide. But the act of writing it down is not to be smited.
No, it's just very me that eventually, during the midst of everyone else just letting loose, I was still taking notes for future projects and making sure everyone in line for the bathroom wasn't cutting, which is apparently something that will cut through any drug that I take. Like, no matter what, I'm still going to make sure the rules are being followed. It's
absolutely true. Case for me too. I mean, yeah, I'm out there and I'm dancing and stuff, but like, I separated myself from everyone and was having on my, you know, my own solo thing of thinking of these things. I could have just been, you know, socializing like a normal, well, I guess burning like a normal weirdo.
So you were creating,
but yeah,
creating in that moment.
I get the reason, like, I had to abandon people, and I don't feel great about it in the long run. No, I guess I do in the long run, but in the short term, that guy's a dick.
Yeah, people aren't always worth surrounding ourselves with. You got to take breaks from them. I really hope that I get to one day see that absolutely filthy play. It sounds magical. You've been in a ton of stuff that I am a huge fan of. I'm a massive Community fan. Parks and Rec is so much joy. Key and Peele, which you got an Emmy nomination for as one of the writers on that. Are all of these projects coming through just very organically through the relationships that you have from Second City and Boom Chicago? Or did you have those moments where you're just living in LA and going on auditions or submitting writer samples?
Both. Between like knowing people or auditioning. You know, Jordan and I worked together at Boom for almost 3 years. We had a two-man show, in fact, that we did in Edinburgh. And when Boom Chicago came to Second City to do a swap, which we did 2 years in a row, that's when Jordan met Keegan, and I did as well. And I mean, Keegan, the first time you see Keegan Michael Key on stage, it's like,
it's incredible.
This dude.
I mentioned he was at UCB when I was out in LA, and it was like, just takes over.
He was in the ETC show at the time, and that cast had a bunch of people who I was, you know, already knew were good, you know, Jack McBrayer and Pete Gross, I believe. And you go in, and then like, who's this guy? More than holding his own with people who I already, you know, respect and admire. I got called in and invited to work on their Super Bowl special that I wrote for, not the whole show. But you know, they also brought me in to be on the regular show a few times, and that was nice. But the Community and Parks and Rec, those are straight up auditions. You know, the old fashioned way.
So
Not the oldest.
Right? Well, I mean, it is Hollywood. Yeah. We've all heard about it. So congrats, I guess, on being a successful lover. You've accomplished great things via the old-fashioned way. So Reno 911, Parks and Rec, Community, How I Met Your Mother. Then you end up in a couple films with Jason Sudeikis, who you also knew from Boom Chicago, We're the Millers and Horrible Bosses 2. All of these things are accomplishments in their own right. But it feels to me, and I heard you mention this on another podcast, that this Ted Lasso moment for you, this character, the show's popularity, all of it has catapulted you into a very different space. Is that fair to say that the last, I don't know, 8 or 9 months has suddenly been very different for you?
Yes and no, because like it's all under the auspices of, not auspices, but under the umbrella of COVID stuff. So, you know, I hear tell that if you have a hit show and you go out and about, suddenly all the doors open up and the dispensaries roll out a green carpet just for you. None of that has occurred yet. And it's kind of a 24-hour job, you know, when you're producing it and writing it and in it. So there's not too much time to like experience much of a life difference, you know. Having said that, like, that 24-hour day job is the greatest. Mm-hmm. It's the most fulfilling thing, artistically and in terms of rewards, and in terms of, you know, it's now, I mean, it's me and Jason and Joe Kelly were the original creators. And then, you know, Bill Lawrence comes along, but in terms of me and Joe and Jason, those are old friends. These are guys I've known for over 20 years who are now, you know, people I'm seeing every day or getting in touch with every day, at least to get to work. But now the writers are friends, and the cast are friends, and the crew are friends. Like, it's just, it's a pretty cool moment. And then we'll see, you know, we'll see how long it lasts or crashes violently to the ground. Who knows?
I do love reading all the stories about the true friendships, you know, Juno and Hannah becoming great friends. And you and obviously Jason Sudeikis have been friends for a long time. It is the dream. Right. When you see my examples are always like Lonely Island or like Beastie Boys, you know, like people that they can go back and show you the movies or the songs they made in their teens, and then they become grown ass adults and they're still loving the work that they do. It's really incredible. So I want to take you back to the ad campaign that you co-wrote with Sudeikis for the Premier League. It was NBC Sports taking on the rights. And in it, there was this football coach, Ted Lasso, who was, you know, going to coach Tottenham, and all the interesting idiosyncrasies and fish out of water tales of what that would look like. It was very funny at the time. You would have never convinced me it would make for a show. In fact, when I saw the previews for Ted Lasso, I believe I recall saying specifically to my husband, "That looks f-ing stupid," which I now regret deeply. But at the time, I just didn't really get what we were doing here. And then I, you know, a couple people said it's good. I'm like, give it a shot. I already bought Apple TV Plus for, you know, the morning show, so might as well. And then boom, like halfway through the first, I'm still a little skeptical. I'm like, okay. And then halfway through the first, I cannot get the smile off my face. And there is just this warmth that I cannot describe other than when I'm watching the show Making It with Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman, which is a crafting show that is entirely meant to only make you feel warmth and joy. There is no other reason for that show to exist. Whereas Ted Lasso has many other facets to it, but incredible. So I know that Jason said he had this character in his mind for years after that. Were you also always thinking about Ted Lasso, or was it not until he came back around and said, could we make something of this, that it was resurfaced? Or was this a build for that 7 years of, can we do something?
Yeah. So we did the first one, just had the greatest time, you know, and, but it was, you know, it was 3 days and we're done and off we go. Then the next year they want us to do it again. I'm like, oh, okay. All right. Well, sure. And then we find out, you know, that they've been watching the original more or as much in the UK as in the States. Like, oh, really? What? Huh? And then we work with Tim Howard on that. And we find out from Tim Howard that they're watching it in, you know, Premier League locker rooms. I'm like, what? Okay. And we just had a real good time doing that second one. And, you know, Jason has talked about, you know, it sort of unlocked a piece of the character, you know, about his sort of curiosity and you know, being a better coach, albeit in that case to little girls. So pretty quickly at that point, we're like, you know, Jason particularly was like, there's something else here. What is it? Is it more commercials? Is it a movie? Is it a TV show? Whatever. And soon enough, he calls us to his place in Brooklyn, and the three of us, you know, sort of beat out a season over the course of a week. You know, and we put together an actual pilot script, a lot of which is in the pilot you end up seeing. And then nothing. And like Joe and Jason, they're doing pretty great at that point. You know, Jason, you know, everything Jason doing, you know, Joe's been on How I Met Your Mother for years. And then he, you know, show runs Detroiters at Comedy Central. I'm over here in LA just doing a commercial when I can. Hey guys, are we doing that Ted Lasso thing? Oh, you're having another child? Okay.
Take
wait until that child is grown. So I think technically in that period, I was thinking about Ted Lasso more than anyone has thought of anything, because it was, you know, it was a real like life preserver that I couldn't reach, for a long ass time. And then, Jason does this, a couple of different charity events in Kansas City, but there's one called Thunder Gong that I went and did, where I performed as my, character, Elvis Costello, the Elvis Presley impersonator who only does Elvis Costello songs. And on the way back, literally at baggage claim, like we've been together all weekend. We're hanging out. There's plenty of time to bring this up. I've met his family. We've gone to barbecue. Been great. Hey, is that that Ted Lasso stuff? Is that still online somewhere? Yeah, man. Yeah, it's online somewhere. Yeah, it's online. Oh, good. I meet with Bill Lawrence tomorrow, and then, you know, He literally shrugged. He doesn't finish the sentence.
Bill Lawrence, just like, a guy who's created a whole bunch of extremely successful shows. And
yeah, an absolute titan of television. And then things moved along pretty quickly. A couple months later, you know, the four of us have dinner together, and then Jason and Bill go and start pitching it. Apple Bites, which is the reverse of how it's supposed to go. And then like a month after that, we had a writer's room and we were off.
So we talk a lot about, or we've heard a lot about Ted Lasso's character, and it's been really interesting to read some of the profiles of Jason Sudeikis of late and how other people had to let him know that Ted Lasso is very much him. At first, he used to joke about how it wasn't, and then he realized that there was very much of the character within himself. What about Coach Beard? Because the development of Lasso changed a fair amount from those funny ads where he was the gruff American idiot to now this evolved and thoughtful and full of these wonderful platitudes and thoughts Ted Lasso character. Coach Beard didn't do much in those ads. He was a similar role of telling him what he needed to know and being informative. But how did you develop that character and how much of it is you?
Well, it did start with their commercials of like being the soccer translator. Kind of like Obama's anger translator, yeah, that Keegan played for Jordan. Yeah. I was Ted's soccer translator. And, you alluded to that that unlikely fan thing I did and kicked this, when I was sort of dabbling in soccer comedy for a minute there, which is not a genre, not really worth dabbling in, frankly, but it passed the time. But it had become my sort of mission to tell friends of mine who I knew were sports fans but hadn't gotten into soccer, much as I had been, circa 1999, like that it's awesome, and I would literally translate it for people. I'd really literally be like, oh yeah, okay, this is Arsenal, this is Thierry Henry, and like they're kind of Showtime Lakers, spiritually, not success wise. So that was, I'd had literal conversations like that with Jason in years past, and so we just built on that. So that part of Beard is 100% me. What's the word? Not truculent, doesn't talk much. Fancy word for not talk much. That I'm less like. I overtalk. I tell stories that don't go anywhere. People are left hanging. The night is ruined. It's happened more than once. But it was important that he do talk less because, Ted has to be the one who talks a lot and he's got to just kind of fill in the gaps. But finally, the piece that we do think is the same, but we have not explored much yet on the show, maybe we will, maybe we not, is Beard's got some kind of history. Mm-hmm. He's got some kind of, darkness, things he's seen, things he's fighting against, things he pretended never happened.
Answers he's dated. Yeah, there's a lot to get to.
Yeah. And, Ted has assisted in pulling him out of whatever hole he was in. Perhaps that hole was shaped like a K. I don't know. There are definitely similarities enough that, there are things to draw from.
Taciturn is, I think, what you were looking for.
Boom. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
This is a podcast that loves words. So I never use taciturn because I'm always describing myself as loquacious. I've never touched anything near taciturn, perhaps maybe just right after birth. And then very quickly thereafter, I discovered words. We'll get right back to the interview. But first, what is your favorite word?
Euphemism.
Euphemism. Good one. Okay. 1650s is when it first appeared from Greek euphemismos, which means use of a favorable word in place of an inauspicious one. Superstitious avoidance of words of ill omen during religious ceremonies. And it started out in English as a rhetorical term at first, the sort of broader sense of, quote, choosing a less distasteful word or phrase than the one meant didn't come around to 1793. So examples can be a sort of substitution, like marital aid instead of sex toy. Could be a metaphor, like bun in the oven instead of pregnant. Or a total circumlocution, so completely speaking around a word. So, for instance, a mobster saying someone is sleeping with the fishes instead of dead. Or the Real Housewives of New Jersey cast saying Joe and Teresa Giudice went away instead of went to prison. Euphemism. It's a good one. Also, I like way overdo that. Was that a euphemism? Instead of like phrasing. Because I'm a child. Because I'm a 12-year-old boy. Speaking of great words,
you're going to learn today.
The word of the week is actually a phrase in honor of Ted Lasso, a very British slang phrase that I find delightful. A damp squib. Quite literally, a wet explosive. Something that fails on all accounts, as often a wet explosive does. So according to Enemy Online, squib originated in the 1520s, meaning short bit of sarcastic writing or witty scoff. But the origin is unknown, and the same word, but meaning small firework that burns with a hissing noise, is also first appearing in the 1520s. So that might be the original one, making the witty scoff definition sort of imitative. So a funny one-liner landing like a hissing explosion. So I love it even more now, and I intend to incorporate squib in both meanings into my lexicon from here on out. Damp showed up in the late 14th century to suffocate with, you know, a damp, foul air in a mine from the noun damp. But the more common to moisten was first recorded in the 1670s. And I apologize to everyone who hates the word moist. I don't like it either. I really only use it to describe cakes because there's no other good way to describe a good moist cake. I said it again. Sorry. All right. Damp squib in a sentence. After all that buildup, the Olympic debut efforts from the USA women's soccer team and men's hoops team really were a damp squib. Now let's get back to the interview. I heard you talk about Roy Keane being the inspiration for Roy Kent. And one of the things I love about the characters in this and why it doesn't feel like a traditional sitcom is that there is an evolution that is very clear. And I read an interview with Juno talking about Keeley and how much she loved the character, in part because the expectation you have for that character as this tardy little groupie is very quickly gone. And she's strong and smart and capable and ambitious. And I feel the same way about the Roy Kent character, that it could become sort of a very static foil for Ted Lasso and the optimism that is around him. But then we find out he goes to a yoga group with moms and he coaches and loves his little niece and all these things. It feels so intentional the way the show subverts things. Is that always intentional? Was it like from the start, we're going to pick all the things that are traditional in sitcoms and turn them on their head? Or is it just in the development of it, your natural sensibilities are to seek out things that aren't stereotypical or simplified or, you know, alpha beta kind of ways of looking at humans?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's more we looked at sports movie sort of tropes and iconography, you know, because you just see so many of them, you know, good and bad, and they have things in common. And this was going to be, you know, some kind of sports movie like story. But, you know, yeah, I had an improv coach named Josie O'Reilly in Amsterdam, who had this exercise that I had not, didn't recall doing in Chicago. It's called Heighten and Explore. And she would, you know, you would say something and she would say heighten. And like you keep, you keep talking about that thing, you literally heighten it. And then explore was, okay, now move on to something else. And so she would like sort of call you out like a conductor. And I think that's basically kind of what we did with these basic, you know, sort of sports movie icons. You know, like we take it in. You know, Rebecca is, you know, she's got some DNA as the lady from Major League, but we, you know, we heightened on that. And, you know, we explored really inward when we explored, because it was like, why is she this way? It can't just be, you know, ha ha ha, you know, cackling Maleficent. even though now we know Maleficent's deeper too.
Gosh, everybody has to be, like, even people who want to like cut up little dogs and make them into a coat have to have some sort of backstory.
What have we done as a society?
Some people are just evil, Brendan. Okay, we need to
just be evil.
That.
it is intentional. Sort of look at these things. But I wouldn't say that we then externally tried to change them or externally tried to put a twist on them. We looked at all of them we looked inward on all of them and just tried to find organic places to take them, as opposed to saying, you know, it would be a twist. you know, going from there.
Well, and I think that's another reason why I like it so much. And I hadn't thought about it in so many words until I saw a Twitter thread about it a couple months ago. The idea that in sitcoms, people are always fucking up and it's annoying. If you have an elevated sense of any kind of content, you know, books, movies, television, at some point you're like, okay, we've seen this trope a million times. Just don't, like, I liked it, but I didn't love like Meet the Fockers. I don't really enjoy when it's just like the same person f***s up over and over and they don't seem to learn from it. And it's constantly like, did it again. It's just not my jam. Right. So watching this show, and every time there's a setup that you think the person is going to say or do the wrong thing, there's another character that swoops in and speaks to them like an actual human being that lives in reality instead of showbiz and sitcom world. That is such a difference, because it doesn't then fall into, maybe to your point, at some point you stop heightening and you explore instead. And the heightening eventually doesn't have a payoff anymore if it's disconnected from the way actual people interact with each other. That's got to be intentional, right? That's not sports tropes then. That's more sitcom tropes that you want to skewer.
First of all, I think that was an incredibly well-phrased question.
Thanks.
And the intentionality there was partially based in, you know, we didn't want it to get broad. Like, we really wanted to be fairly, you know, fairly real, because we're coming in with a broad premise. Like, it's a ridiculous premise that, you know, would never happen. So let's play it all out as seriously as possible with as real characters as possible. Not as seriously as possible. And so anytime that we started to go off in a direction that was like, and, you know, and then, you know, like, because improv can go this way a lot. In comedy sports, we called it, and then aliens eat Elvis. You know, like, that's the only place, right? You know, Elvis, aliens eat Elvis at the White House. And anytime we started to get toward any of those three elements of heightening, Jason would be like, no, how about they just apologize? Basically.
Yeah.
So there was an intention in the room to, like, keep things realistic, but then a very clear, you know, mission inside Jason that was about just real conversation. And and I think that has proved a richer playing field in the long run.
I've seen a lot of shows that you can tell the people at the helm have very progressive ideas about feminine and masculine roles, about social issues that are at the forefront of things. And try as they might, they either become excessively saccharine in their attempt to weave those morals and messages in, or preachy to the point where you become disconnected from the characters and the plot because you're aware of the writing intending to do something that will elicit a response or clapping and platitudes for having put that in the script. Somehow the show avoids that, despite touching on some, and in second season, no spoilers, there are some real life kind of sports social issue crossovers that are addressed. And it does so in a way that is, and I'm sure you've heard this over and over, surprisingly effective. Like, instead of judging the decency and the warmth and the joy and the messages, people love that they're in there and that they're communicated in a way that doesn't feel like it kicks you in the head or the balls. I don't know what metaphor I was going for. I think I meant knocks you over the head. And then I went with, anyway, to what do you ascribe that ability and that fine line that you've managed to hit?
Well, without giving, you know, too much away, it's just that there's, it partially started from, you know, we love soccer and we want to, without being a soccer show, we want to, like, you know, communicate our love for the game, but it would be disingenuous to not acknowledge that there are some systemic problems in soccer, you know, as in the world. So what you see in the show happen ends up being a very, like, analogized version of a confluence of stuff that's not just soccer, but also, you know, I mean, there's a little bit of Kaepernick in there, but what the Clippers did.
Right.
When Donald Sterling's, you know, real self kind of got broadcast out there. But there's some, it's so hard to say without getting into spoilers, but basically, you know, some players, there's always been, like, in some countries more than others, and still today, there's racial abuse getting shouted at players from so-called fans. And it only in the last 5 years or so have teams started to actively, while on the pitch, take action against it. I mean, even, I think just last week, the German Olympic soccer team had a walk off the pitch,
right.
You know, because the powers that be are not doing enough and they need to do more. Anyway, so that, we, because it's a comedy show And because we don't want to, we don't want to get too big for our britches, essentially, or speak where we don't know enough. We don't delve into a, well, no, it's a real thing that happened, but we don't quite get into a fully real thing or fully hot button issue. So it's a bit allegorical. But the feedback we're getting is that, yeah, it's been pretty effective. And yeah, I'm glad we're not kicking you in the balls, Sarah. That would be inappropriate.
And difficult to do because I don't have balls. But the show, like you said, is based on premises that would never happen. So let's keep, you know, playing the game. I didn't just yes and you on my balls. I apologize. I sort of said yes, and my balls are enormous. So missing them is actually tough.
Let the record show Sarah started the balls.
I did.
Look at the
tape. There's no HR on this podcast, but I would always be the one that gets in trouble. There's some lines in the script that I imagine you read it occasionally, and without the incredible acting of the people on the show, which is another aspect of this that I could go on forever about, just how perfect the lines have to be hit for them to be enjoyable and for you not to think about the writing. But ones like, you know, you're beating yourself up is like Woody Allen playing a violin, I don't want to hear it, or, you know, something about riding a horse and if you're doing it wrong, I don't know. There's a bunch of them that are like these very colloquial, fun things. But if I were reading a script, I might think that's over the top, right? And instead it hits. Are there moments when you guys are writing where you're like, we've gone too far? Like, this one is not going to work when it actually comes out of someone's mouth.
Well, that's why you do alts, as they're called. Industry term, alts, alternative lines. Because, yeah, there's a bunch on the cutting room floor that is like, nope, that was just too many. But they're fun to write. And we have a writer's room full of funny people and who are more than joke writers. And we really don't focus on joke writing. But when we get to, like, we need a Tedism here, then it's a fun whip round of spontaneous joke writing. Yeah. Everyone trying to speak in Ted's voice. And, you know, Jason, of course, has the highest batting average of any of us in doing that. But I think, you know, because there were so many of those Tedisms that you can't quite picture how it's going to go yet in that first pilot, I think that might be why, you know, a few of the big streamers were like, this is broad. this guy talks crazy.
Yeah.
They lacked vision. And here we are.
Apple's congratulations, right. Apple. A couple more quick ones for you about the show and the creativity behind it. I've heard that there is a 3-season arc, that was always the plan. This makes me very sad. The last time I remember being like, where there was plenty of show left and I was so distraught was when I got to Fleabag late, and I was like 3 episodes in and I was like, wow, how many seasons of this are there? I'm so excited. I've only watched 3 episodes, and I Google it, it's like Fleabag done after 2 seasons, and I was like, what? I'm so sad. I want to watch this for the rest of my life. And that's how I was feeling watching like the first couple episodes of season 2. Like, instead of just the joy that season 1 brought me, there was also a deep, dark anxiety that this would one day end, and then where would I go for this feeling of joy other than, of course, making it. Can we work around this arc? Like, does it have to be 3?
I don't know. We'll see. You know, we start writing season 3 in about a month. And that'll be the start of conversations about that. We've definitely always seen it as a 3-season arc. We definitely know where folks are supposed to go, but we did not ever foresee the degree to which people love the show. Same. And it's possible that the good old, I don't know, it people who have a lot invested in this show doing well might wish to challenge our resolve here. I don't know if they will or not, because certainly the Fleabag model, it's a hell of a model. I mean, that show is going to live forever.
Yeah. Ye old and, purse strings. You know, it'll be the one time I'm rooting for the purse strings to be the deciding factor in how something goes.
Yeah. I just don't know that will affect Jason much. But
right.
We'll
see. I mean, you did say we have to discover more about Coach Beard. So, you know, there's always the spinoff. When in doubt, there's always a spinoff. I want to ask you quickly about Southport Lanes and how you were, what was the name you called the job? Pinboy.
Oh yeah.
I've never heard that until you posted it. But Southport Lanes is this bowling alley bar place in Chicago that's literally lasted through a previous plague and prohibition and all of these things. And finally, was brought to its knees by 2020. And I feel like you and Jason Sudeikis should buy it. What are we doing here?
Oh, boy. Maybe Jason should, but it's already too late, right? They sold out everything. Like, they didn't, it felt, you know, sometimes the place is going under and they'll put up a press thing that's like, well, looks like we're going to have to fold.
Somebody better help, otherwise it's over.
These press releases made it sound like it was freaking over, but it was a great job. Yeah. So for people who've never been to Southport Lanes, it is a 4-lane bowling alley that is, the lanes are handled manually by pin setters, which in my day were always high school kids. and we'd have 2 lanes each, me and another guy. And it was always, you know, never anyone who I was particularly friends with, but we'd meet up and it felt like, you know, blue collar work. It was incredibly dangerous, especially on league night when you had some, you know, 6'3", 250-pound just cannon arms, because there was nothing to stop the pins from going up to where you were standing, and they would just helicopter
right to your chin
off the walls. They would get close enough that I could hear them whip around me and then end up 3 lanes over to where my partner was standing, just land at his feet, and we'd look at each other like, that was close. And then we get back into it. But I absolutely loved working there, and I loved that job in retrospect. The one night Frank Mathey from WLS came in and did like a human.
Yeah, I'm going to try to find that for you. I know you mentioned that. I think I told you that I was able to find old footage for my husband and I's first date at Wrigley when we were caught on camera. So I'm going to go looking for it, and I'm going to see if there's a, you know, spare bowling pin or beer bottle I can get for you. Cause according to the internet, it does say the auction is underway. So it has been cleared out. I guess you and Sudeikis can't save it.
It's called Pinhaven. And that's partially a nod. The pin part is a nod to those.
What's it called?
Pinhaven.
No way.
If Brendan meets Raven and Pinhaven sounded like a word that probably didn't exist.
Oh.
One quick thing on this Frank Mathey, though. It had the greatest tag ever, because my partner that night was some, you know, metalhead who didn't want to be on camera for reasons that I found suspicious. So I'm the only pin boy in the whole report. And at the end, he's standing outside Southport Lanes and says, in his Frank Mathey way, because it's Southport Lanes, they don't call it Brunswick, they call it Brendan. I'm Frank Mathey.
Oh, we got to find that. That's classic. That's classic. Really quickly, you're working on a play right now. Is this simultaneous to getting ready and geared up for season 3?
Not exactly. I had a play that was supposed to open between the 2 seasons. It's called The Art Couple. It was supposed to open at the Kirk Douglas last year. It's supposed to open March 18th.
How'd that
March
go?
12th, that all changed. Oh, man. I'll never forget the rehearsal where we found out that Tom Hanks had it and that an NBA game had stopped. And that's weird. We're not showing up tomorrow, are we? Like, the sets were up. It was, you know, the biggest theater any of my, you know, plays have probably been performed in. It may yet come back, but that's my big COVID asterisk.
Yeah.
So I really hope it comes back around.
I'd like to think that you have only increased your ability to get a theater of that size and scope based on the last months or so. So maybe we'll be even bigger and better when it comes back. Ted Lasso spin on all of it, right? Something that is delayed is not denied, I believe is the saying. So maybe there's nice time. You have to do the one thing everybody does and nobody expects. It's the Spanish Inquisition.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's 10 questions that everybody answers. Number one, your current careers are canceled. What job do you do instead?
Oh, boy. Tour guide.
Oh, that would be amazing. Like a duck boat. That would be awesome. Chicago architecture tour right down the river. Number two, what's the most scared you've ever been?
I was at a Ajax game where I wasn't that close to it, but from where I was standing, I could see that the away fans had broken a barrier and were stampeding into like seats. And at that point you start looking around like, oh, this is what we've always read about happening. It starts like this. it turned out fine.
Oh, that's terrifying. Number three, you can be the best in the world at any one thing for one day. What is it?
Bowling. I'm not that good a bowler for some reason. Bowling all over so long and it bugs me.
You spend a lot of time on the wrong end of the lane. Can't blame yourself, right? Number four, what current celebrity from music, politics, TV, sports do you wish was your best friend?
Thierry Henry.
Ooh.
You know, he's classy. He's urbane. He's amusing. Has great stories, I'm sure. Yeah. And I met him one time before this whole thing, and I was hammered. So I think I could do
you
better.
Can do better, okay. Number five, what's your biggest, most meaningless pet peeve?
People who laugh at their own jokes when it wasn't a joke. You know, like, oh my God, I went down to McDonald's today. Stop it! Stop it! Why are you doing that?
Number six, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
My sister walked in on me when I was about to start masturbating. Oh, no. And I heard her hand on the door. I successfully got my pants back on in time and like was like this, but I had not gotten the magazine away. So the magazine, you know, I'm lying there under my refrigerator Perry poster, my Black and Blues Brothers poster. She giggled and closed the door. Now she
not does. To be judgmental, because to each their own, but maybe it's best there was a magazine and she didn't think it was perhaps Refrigerator Perry that was the focus of your efforts.
Or Tom Sayre.
Tom, good looking bald guy. Yep. I don't know. Like, I don't want to make any judgments on what gets people going.
Put a fedora on him, and I'm telling you, that makes the unbold
think. I've told this story before, but my dad and I went out of state for a Junior Olympics event when I was in high school. We went to the movie theater and there were two movies. And we just picked the one that looked like it was like fun and for younger people since I was like 15. And it was American Pie. So just me and my dad sitting in the theater to an opening scene of a guy jerking off in a sock. So memories. Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
My discipline.
In terms of all things or specific things?
In terms of all things. Like the main one now is food. Like I don't have a particularly cultured palate and I'm not afraid of fast food particularly, but I far too often I'm like, I gotta stop having fries, no matter how good they are. I gotta stop so having fries. Oh look, fries.
Are you an all or nothing person or a moderation?
I'm far more all or nothing than moderation.
Cause that's one of the keys. There's this woman I had on my podcast, her original book that everyone kind of got into is The Happiness Project, but she also writes books about habits. And one of the things she does is helps you identify like what's your pattern. Cause if you keep trying to apply something that works for someone else, but your way of doing things is not that, it's never going to work for you. So like, if you try to do moderation and you can't, you're better off just saying, I never get fries. Then you have to figure out your approach. Like never having fries is a bad approach though to life. So maybe you just, maybe it's like once a month I get fries.
Both, you know, literally and metaphorically.
Very true. Number eight, any musician or band alive or dead can play your next party. Who is it?
Prince.
Oh, did you get to see him when he was alive?
Yes, a couple times. Once at Staples and once in that crazy long forum. Run that
yeah,
he had.
That's awesome. So good. So that's electric. I got to see him at City Winery with only 400 of us when he played a secret show after George Lucas's wedding. And they just said it. My husband saw a local news anchor post on Facebook. The tickets were about to go on sale. It was a random pop-up City Winery. He was 2 hours late. We stood outside for 2 hours and then he crushed with like a 22-piece brass band on tiny little City Winery stage. It was epic. Number nine, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Never properly auditioning for SNL, not SNL, Second City first. Mm-hmm. Never properly auditioning for Second City and going on that track, which, you know, no guarantee I would have gotten very far on that track, but I at least would know.
Too late now?
And not. Yeah, I don't think you can be in your 40s and audition for Second City. That's a young man's game over there. And, you know, it turns out it's worked out okay.
Yeah.
So I regret it less than I used to, but it's a big sliding doors moment is after Amsterdam, maybe I shouldn't have moved straight to LA where, you know, like I crashed a car the first week because I hadn't driven in 5 years. maybe I should have moved back to Chicago and been a little more patient.
Yeah. Number 10, what three individual words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Funny. Empathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Or caring. Caring but empathetic. Mm-hmm. Funny, caring, and you can find a fancier word for it, you with your love of words, but good smelling.
Good smelling. Olfactorily pleasant. there's got to be.
Your game, individual words. That was your.
That's true. I did say it was just one, but you then challenged me. There's got to be a big word for good. Odoriferous.
Oh.
Odoriferous.
Okay.
That's what we'll go with. And it's fun to say.
Yeah.
Okay. Bonus question. Who should I have in this podcast? It doesn't matter what job or industry, just someone you think I would find interesting.
Andrew Moskos, the owner of Boom Chicago.
Ooh, that would be a really good one. I bet he's got stories.
Yeah.
For days. Thanks for coming on. This was extremely fun and you are a delight.
You are a delight, Sarah. I mean, I've been a fan of you for a while and I hear you in the car.
Oh,
and
nice.
To be asked on here was thrilling.
Thank you.
That's what she said.
Oh, yeah. One more thing. This is where I rant about something, rave about something, tell you what to read, watch, listen to. I think it's pretty clear you should watch Ted Lasso. I mean, how much more do I got to say, people? How much more do I got to say? Brendan Hunt is a delight. The show is a delight. I want us all to embrace decency and not think it's a fantasy. I want us all to try our best to be good people and not let cynicism tell us that it's okay to just sink into the shit. Is that really so much to ask people? Watch the show. It's amazing. You can always tweet me at Sarah Spain if you've got guest suggestions, questions, or more. And you should always go to the iTunes or podcast app. Subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Rate it 5 stars, please. Give a review. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's What She Said.